Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, Squawker Talker listeners. We've got something a bit different for you today. The Squawker Talker will be back next week. In the meantime, we proudly present the first episode of a new podcast we've created for Deezer Originals. It's called Defending in Numbers and stars a couple of Squawker Talker favourites and a new host, Rob Armstrong. Give it a listen, tell us what you think, and don't forget to subscribe to the new show over on Deezer, iTunes, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Without further ado, here's episode one of Defending in Numbers.
Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Welcome to Defending in Numbers, the podcast where we walk through the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we actually do. My name is Rob Armstrong, and helping me pretend today is the most electrifying man in all of football statistics. George Ellick, how are you this morning?
Yeah, I'm good. Are we going to get that every week?
Absolutely.
Good.
And then something a little bit more easy to rhyme. A man flexing his statissimus dorsi muscles. It's Dave O'Brien. Dave, how are you in your stats this morning?
Yeah, they're good. They're ready to go. They're ready to escape.
It's good that you're both so energised, because just for the listeners out there, we are recording this at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I think this is a wild time to be talking about football statistics. Is this how you start every day, Dave?
Usually, you know, wake up, have a shot of espresso, then look into the mirror and chant stats at myself. So I'm just going to be doing that today, really.
What's your favourite morning stat, George?
No, it's kind of a natural progression, because you normally dream about stats, then you kind of wake up and you go straight into it. I'm ready to go.
Do you live by the stat, die by the stat?
We have to, yeah. Otherwise, what are we doing here?
It gives you meaning. Whatever gives you purpose, lads, that's what I'm saying. And what's going to give me purpose this week is numbers.
Oh, yeah.
The Week by Numbers.
That's right. That informative jingle tells you that we're going to go into Week by Numbers. Dave, George, I'm going to say a number.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'm going to tell you something about it. And then you're going to give me some brief thoughts on the matter. Ready for some numbers?
Yeah.
Good. Are you really ready for some numbers? Yeah, you tell me you live by the stat, die by the stat.
I'm waiting. I'm here.
I'm not a statistician, you know. I'm about to throw a number out there. This is big for me. All right. And talking of big numbers, 5.
Woohoo!
That's how many passes Jonjo Shelvey completed before getting sent off for stepping on Dele Alli. What a legend. Stepping on the more talented version of himself. What do you reckon, Jonjo Shelvey? Is he going to be able to cut it at Premier League level, or is he always going to be Newcastle? He's always going to be the sort of nearly man. Is never going to be the Dele Alli that he wants to be.
I think that'll be it. You know, you got to look at the decision making. It was absolutely atrocious. Like, to make that move and to sort of be, you know, taunted and brought in to step on someone it's just a bit embarrassing for someone that's supposed to be leading your team and being the playmaker, being the guy that's going to be moving the ball around. And you saw, as soon as he got sent off, it was game over. Tottenham Hotspur just took control and, you know, absolutely annihilated Newcastle. I think it's one of these things where if Jonjo Shelvey wants to be a Premier League player and a successful one at that, decisions like that need to be completely eradicated. You know, you can't defend what Dele Alli did, but Jonjo Shelvey is just an absolute no-no. And I think Newcastle may struggle this season. I don't think they've made any signings that have been, for me, yeah, these guys are going to stay up. You're thinking Dwight Gayle's still their number 9, Matt Ritchie's still on the wing. They bought Atsu from Chelsea, who's pretty bang average. And that performance against Tottenham showed that it could be a bit of a dangerous season for them.
I do think that number 5 is important, because it shows, I mean, Shelvey's someone who's you know, his ball-playing ability is his key strength. And the fact he only completed 5 passes actually shows what Newcastle were doing in that game. And I think until the red card, they'd done a good job of basically just stymieing, you know, any threat that Spurs had. They sat very deep. They just tried to frustrate them. They didn't really, I mean, they were playing for a 0-0 draw, basically. And I think the game plan was mainly working until Shelvey just had that moment of madness and trodden Alli. And I don't, you know, you said that you can't really defend Dele Alli. You know, I think it's just Newcastle's fault. They're obviously sent out there to wind up the bloke, and they just went one step too far, and that was
stop
that.
It.
Oh God! End the podcast, Dave. How much would it take to provoke you into stepping on someone?
A bit. You know, if anyone was...
That was it.
Yeah.
If anyone bad was discriminating puns. Me with stats or, yeah, or bad puns, then I'd have to just get the boot out and put it in.
What minute was it he got sent off?
47th.
47th. Mm. And he only done five passes.
Not great.
Hopeless.
It's hopeless. But again, Tottenham will dominated the ball, you know, out of the back. They're absolutely excellent. Vertonghen is just one of the best ball-playing centre-halves in the world. And then you've got Alderweireld next to him. You know, it's a great platform. So you expect Tottenham to dominate possession, but at the same time, five passes, 47 minutes. That's atrocious.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed for him. And, yeah. And I'm sure he'll hear this. And he'll be like, yeah, that guy's right. He knows about football. Next number. 24.
No way.
The magic number. Unless you're Cristiano Ronaldo, who's only on the pitch for 24 minutes in the Super Cup the other day. Coming off the bench, scored like was an absolute cracker of a goal, essentially won the game. Then, by all accounts, was a topless man on TV for a while. And then shoved a referee after getting sent off for diving, which wasn't really a dive. Well, do you think it was a dive? I don't. I think it's fairly unanimous it wasn't, right?
Yeah, I don't think it was a dive, but at the same time, you can't be pushing a referee full stop. Remember,
he was such a nerd.
It's one of these things where it's like the sports jock bullying someone, which is just not what we want in our, you know, in football or in our culture. It's just an interesting one. It reminds me of the Wayne Rooney situation where he clapped at a official in the Champions League against Villarreal and got sent off and got a similar like 2 to 3 game ban. But again, Ronaldo shouldn't be doing that type of thing. He's supposed to be the man at Real Madrid. He's supposed to be an icon, and you know, his impact on young people. He can't be showing that type of level of, I don't know, stupidity in a way, and being banned for 5 games, yeah, you'll miss some pretty big games there. And as well, if you two may have seen around Reddit, there's this rumor that's going around that Ronaldo will be moving to Monaco.
Huh. I'm sure he'd enjoy the lifestyle, I'd have thought. But yeah. And maybe the other
perks. It's tax free over there. Yeah.
I think it's a sign. You know, 24 minutes on the pitch. If we didn't already know already, it's just a sign that Ronaldo thinks he can just get away with whatever he wants. We've seen it with great players before. We saw it with Zidane in that World Cup final in his last game. We saw it when Paulo Di Canio pushed over Paul Alcott when playing for Sheffield Wednesday all those years ago. It's just these guys who just have that mentality where they're thinking, this is my stage, I can do what I want, and if you're not going to let me play, I'm going to push you over. Fair enough.
UEFA loner. What do we think, lads?
Not after the Neymar stuff, right? UEFA would have blocked that if they were UEFA loaner.
Seems to me like the money from Neymar has gone straight into that geezer's pocket.
Yep.
Seems the only thing holding him down when Ronaldo pushed him, otherwise he would have fallen over like Paul Alcott.
Would he have got a longer ban maybe if he'd been sent off for actually pushing him?
Probably. It was only 4 games, wasn't it?
4 games was the minimum. It could have gone up to 8.
Wasn't it?
So he actually did all right.
It's one for the sending off, then 4 for the push.
Yeah.
I wonder if he'd pushed him over and been sent off for that, if he'd got more.
Yeah. Maybe. But the one he got, can't you... In Spain, you can appeal a yellow, can't you?
Yeah.
If you get sent off for it.
Yeah.
So he'll surely...
I don't think he'll get off for taking his shirt off. Claim he didn't do it. And...
Prove it. Yeah. Prove that I was topless on national television. But yeah, so it will only be... really. I think he was given the 5-game ban, so realistically it will only be 4 because he'll get the other one overturned.
Still, it's a big impact.
And then one in the Super Cup, which is kind of like a glorified friendly. So it's a 3-game ban.
Yeah, I think it
was worth it.
Yeah, it was kind of worth it in a way. Well, I think for Zinedine Zidane, what we've seen from Gareth Bale in pre-season, then you've got the likes of Asensio coming through the ranks. Ronaldo, yes, he's a player that scores a hell of a lot of goals and carried them in the Champions League, but they're kind of like, for these 4 games, they've got players that can come in and replace him. That's what Zinedine Zidane's built at Real, this perfect squad. I love how Ronaldo's sort of moved to be more of a central striker. You know, think about the system Real were playing, a 4-4-2 diamond.
Am I right?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, the central streaker. But coming in, you know, with strength, Ronaldo, it's, you know, staying high up, counter-attacking. And we saw that for the goal, coming into that stronger right foot. Simpler than anything. Gerard Pique had an absolute stinker, scored an own goal, and then pretty much let Ronaldo score that goal. You know what Ronaldo's going to do from that angle, coming into that right foot. It's classic Ronaldo. So I think for Real Madrid, again, it puts them a massive advantage over Barcelona, given that Neymar's gone, given that they're still searching for this Andres Iniesta, not replacement, but a guy that can just play more minutes than him, because obviously Iniesta's
injury record. So not Jonjo Shelvey then, no?
Not Jonjo Shelvey, because he only completes 5 passes in 47 minutes. That wouldn't work at Barca. You get sacked straight away.
Sorry, Shelvey, you're out. Dave?
Yes?
You like the number 31?
I do like it, actually. Nemanja Matic's number at Manchester United.
Forget about him. Well, who's that guy, right? What's he ever going to do? He'll never make it in a Premier League. Not when he comes across top opposition on the opening day, in which 31 goals were scored, opening weekend even, but 4 of them scored against West Ham United, for God's sake. And 30% of them scored by Burnley, Huddersfield and Watford. are they going to be really good? Or is it just that thing where opening day of the season or opening weekend of the season and there are just a few surprises, people underestimate people and all of a sudden you get crazy results?
I think, yeah, people do underestimate these teams. Certainly Watford are a team who I think have been grossly underestimated throughout the summer. Their business has been very shrewd, and Marco Silva, they've definitely got one of the most talented and promising coaches in Europe, in my opinion. I think he proved that last season. Having a manager whose home record has been so good across his career is no fluke. They'll be very, very good at Vicarage Road this season. And to be honest, they were unlucky, probably unlucky, not to go out of sight early on against Liverpool. Mm. And then Burnley are playing against Chelsea, probably the best time to play them. They're kind of in disarray at the moment, I'd say, Chelsea. After their summer, having won the Premier League, they're not the team they were at the back end of last season.
Yeah, what was their bench? Two people on it, they don't have any players.
They don't have any players. Now they're going to have Fabregas and Cahill suspended. Cahill for three games, Fabregas for one. It's not ideal for them at all. And in Huddersfield, they went away to a really, really poor Palace team, really. And there have got to be question marks over De Boer's managerial ability. Obviously, at Ajax, he was very, very good. But since then, he only lasted till November or October, I think it might have been, at Inter. And he's kind of up against the wall straight away now at Palace. So whilst on paper, they're not the three most glamorous teams in the Premier League, it's maybe not that surprising when you look a bit deeper that they've done well.
I feel like with Huddersfield, it's one of those things where you get a team and it's their first time in the league. Often people just don't really know what to expect from them. They can almost ride on it for the first half of the season. You think back to like Blackpool, was it?
Yeah.
Did something very similar. And I'm sure there's other cases where a team is almost safe or is on 33 points by January or something like that when they're completely new to the league.
Mm.
Is that going to be the case with Huddersfield? Are people going to work them out, or is Wagner the boy?
It's going to be a really interesting one. I think this is one of the most fascinating ones in the Premier League, because I expected Huddersfield to shock a lot of teams early doors, like you mentioned. I think they will go on a run, but again, defensively, I don't think they're going to be good enough when push comes to shove, when teams work out, let's play these guys on the break.
Again, yeah.
Let's go long against them, let's counter-attack against them. I think that's the big thing with Palace. Stylistically, it fell into Wagner's hands in a way. You know, De Boer wants to play out the back from a team that last season played Sam Allardyce football. You know, we can't forget that. It's going from one polar opposite in football style to another one. Going from a defensive backs against the wall, we're going to play long, to a possession-based style is one of these things that it's going to take a little bit longer than a pre-season to get that style on the plane. And with Huddersfield, they press high, they nick the ball high up the pitch. Someone with Moyer midfield, I think he's a brilliant signing. He looks very energetic. And I sort of question why Pep Guardiola let him go, because he could have been a good squad player at Manchester City this season.
Yeah.
And it seems like a bit of a weird one for him. In terms of Watford, I can't agree more with George. Watford are going to be the guys that are going to surprise everyone. I think, you know, what Marco Silva's done in his short career as a manager has been pretty decent, and I think he'll continue that in the Premier League. Liverpool have the same problems. Attack them down the fullbacks. They've got no answer to that. Defenders pull out wide. You've got massive space to exploit, and that's exactly what Watford did. That midfield is there was no impact for me from the likes of Wijnaldum, for Emre Can, and of course Jordan Henderson Holding. They just didn't get involved in the game. They didn't make a forceful impact. The only time that they did was probably when Can, went up front, let's say, and played next to Firmino and laid it off to Mane to score. But apart from that, there was no impact in terms of someone controlling the game. Nobody stepped up. And I think we saw that again against Hoffenheim in the Champions League. If that nothing happens and they just keep sailing through games and they wait for the likes of Firmino, Mane and Salah to create stuff, they're going to really struggle. And I think that's going to be a big problem. Losing Coutinho is huge.
And how about Brighton? Obviously, they had a bit of a rough opening day in the Premier League, losing 2-0 at home to City. But I mean, that City team is outrageous. But what can we expect from Brighton?
I think the Premier League season starts for them next weekend. Basically, that they just draw a line under that. At one point, would have been a huge, huge bonus. Chris Hughton's team are always going to be decent. They're not going to kind of lay down and die. And they'll be good on the break. They'll be comfortable in possession. They've got decent players, kind of across the park, really. So I wouldn't be too concerned for them so far. And losing 2-0 to this Man City team in a couple of weeks could look like quite a good result, I think.
So who's the teams you think are really in trouble this year?
Despite that opening day result, I fear for Burnley. And then
they've got John Walters, though.
They do have Johnny Walters, but they lost Andre Gray, didn't they? I think that's the big one.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, you're not going to like it, but I need to see a lot from West Ham in the next few weeks.
Lions. I mean, surely we're not getting relegated.
I have no confidence in Slaven Bilic at all currently as a manager, and I don't know how long he's going to last. And then if he does get sacked, I have no confidence in the owners in replacing him with anyone particularly shrewd.
Probably get Harry Redknapp in from Birmingham or something.
Wouldn't be a bad call.
Do a job.
He's not a wheeler dealer.
Get Neil Warnock in. He's the one.
Warnock. Warnock. Oh my God, no, he hates us because of Sheffield United, oh, yeah. The Kevin McCarthy.
Imagine that.
Go full circle. Turns out he is a lying hypocrite. Who would have thought it? In the Premier League, all that money. Well, next number. So I've got a piece of paper here, guys. I'm going to pull back the curtain on this. I have a piece of paper with these numbers on. I didn't just remember them when I came in. And I've scribbled 44 out, replaced it with 27. Now I've got 44 again. And that is the number of goals Liverpool have conceded from set pieces since August 2014, the most in the Premier League. Jurgen Klopp, sort it out, right?
I think it is, yeah. I think it's sorted out. I think it comes from Jurgen Klopp. I think it comes from the players not wanting to be aggressive enough. I don't think it's anything to do with the players, you know, not being positioned in the right places. It's they've got to be aggressive. If you play zonal and the ball comes into your area, you have to win it. And that's the thing. We saw, you know, Wijnaldum with that terrible header for the third goal. You've just got to get that out. It's basic defending. I think the problem that with zonal marking that it gets this bad knock because in England we don't do it well at all. You play the same thing for, let's say, Juve or for another Italian or Spanish team and it works perfectly. But it's that aggression that you need. If, you know, the ball comes into your zone, like Firmino, for, I think it was the first goal, the ball comes into your zone, you've got to win it. That's how it goes down to. It goes down to responsibility of a breakdown of an area of the penalty area that you've got to own. And if you don't have that mentality that I'm going to go in there and win every single ball, you're not going to, you know, you're going to struggle and you should go back to a man-orientated system with maybe a guy on one of the posts or, you know, zonal and man is what I'd probably prefer. But again, I don't think it's wrong with the system. It's the players aren't doing what they should be doing.
Now, I also think it's a huge shortcoming of the fact they don't really play the striker. We've seen many, many times in the Premier League and across Europe how you know, strikers, target men, they're born to be aggressive in the box, to get their head on the ball. And we've seen the likes of Drogba and Costa particularly been hugely, hugely helpful to their team defensively for set pieces. And the fact that Liverpool rarely set up with a striker, when they do, it's Sturridge or Origi, neither of whom are really that, you know, that kind of strong, aggressive striker that you're looking for. That's a huge, you know, they're lacking in that area. And if you look at their fullbacks as well, whether it's Klein, whether it's Milner, whether it's Moreno, these aren't guys who are going to win the ball in the air. So when you're setting up for a set piece, you've basically got Matip, Lovren and possibly Chan. You've got three guys who are going to be in any way dominant in the air. Wijnaldum won't do it, Henderson won't do it. They don't have the personnel. So for that reason, it's not surprising they're being beaten consistently. If I was a, you know, 6'4" striker, you know, if I was an Okaka, basically, who scored the first goal on the weekend against them, you'd be fancying your chances every time the ball gets in the box.
Other than a quality song, what does Wijnaldum bring to that team? Old Wijnaldum.
Goals at home, that's it, right?
Bit of energy.
Is that it?
You can run. Well, I don't think Henderson or Chan are particularly good athletes, and he is.
Yeah.
And he's tidy on the ball. But he's someone who'd be useful. If they were firing, he'd be useful to have in the team to knit it all together. He's not going to drag them out of any hole.
And you were saying they've not got the big number nine up front. I saw Firmino has changed his number to number nine. If you're a Liverpool fan and you're seeing that, are you slightly concerned that transfer window is still open, but you've changed your kind of what was originally a sort of winger, sort of attacking midfielder into a striker, and he's now your big number nine? You don't have anyone up there for plan B.
I think the thing that with Firmino is that he played very, very well against Watford, and if everyone put in a performance like Firmino
did, mark me off. Cheers.
then they would have won the game. I think what he brings as a nine, it's not a nine, it's a false nine, so maybe he should have an F over the nine on his shirt, I don't know, something like that. But he worked really well, he worked the channels well, he came deep to the ball at the right time. The pass or chip or lob to Mo Salah for him to tuck it away was wonderful, a brilliant run and a great goal. And I think that's what Firmino could bring Liverpool. It's goals, assists, everything. And I like him as a striker. I think he's a very good striker.
How about
it fits.
As a person?
As a person, I'm not sure. I've never met the fella, so I don't know. I'm not too sure about whether he's a good guy or a bad guy.
Obviously,
he's pals with Coutinho.
He's got good guy's teeth.
He's got good guy. That is true.
You never see a villain with perfect teeth like Firmino. They're practically blue.
Maybe he's the first one then.
Don't say that. It won't go down well. It's like Koeman and his red Christmas lights.
Next number, George. I know you love the number 300, and I know you love it particularly because after scoring for Everton on his Premier League debut, second time, Wayne Rooney has now been involved in 300 Premier League goals. Only Alan Shearer has got more. Do you think this is like a second start for Wayne? Obviously, it is, but do you think it's a start of him finding form again, getting back into the England team and having a couple of years, maybe that he should have had a couple of years ago?
I don't think he'll get back into the England team. Or I mean, at least I kind of hope he doesn't. I think this is the swan song of his career. I think that he'll be a useful player for Everton to have. We saw in his goal on Saturday, the quality he still has. That was an absolutely unbelievable header. He timed his jump to perfection and, you know, the strength to get it back across goal was was really sublime. And in a game that was kind of a pretty dire game really against Stoke, that was the moment of quality that won it. Whether or not suddenly one good performance for Everton in his debut is going to change his career, I'm not convinced. We still have to remember that having a poor first touch and not really having the pace to keep up with play is still going to be an issue at Everton. But fingers crossed that moments of quality like this will get Everton the points that they need to ensure they finish sixth or seventh.
Just a couple of places below West Ham.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mate, what do you reckon? Are you going to want to sign him back in January?
Absolutely not. No, I think.
Did you put a buyback clause in?
I hope not. I hope there was nothing, no talk of that. I think Man United's forward line looks very, very fresh at the moment compared to, you know, with Wayne Rooney and Zlatan last season. Not, you know, Zlatan was good, but Wayne Rooney was terrible. But I think it was a good performance from Wayne Rooney. You know, he moved the ball well, got into the area at the right time. Could have scored again if I think one of the Everton forwards who was played through in the second half had squared it. So it was a good performance and it was a good return to Goodison Park. But I can't see it being anything more than an okay season for Rooney to perform at a level that he's at now, which will be fine, and it'll get Everton the seventh position, which they've paid all that money to get. You know, yeah. Sitting seventh is going to be wonderful.
Nailed down.
I can't wait for his end of season review to say Wayne Rooney performed at a level,
an okay level.
Insert level in stars.
Rooney is a B student.
George, what was your favourite number out of those numbers?
My favourite number, I'd have to say, is probably Ronaldo's 24 minutes.
Oh, Ronaldo. What a half-naked man he was. what a bully.
Yeah, what an absolute
just
bully.
Shoving that referee in the locker.
Yeah, shocking.
Anyway, I've learnt about my numbers this week. Now it's time for me to learn about something else. Next section we're going to for this esteemed podcast is the I'm embarrassed to ask section.
I'm embarrassed to ask.
Basically, I don't know what I'm talking about and I need you guys to clear something up for me.
I thought that was a whole podcast.
Well, it's pretty much my whole life, to be honest. Because I am humiliated.
Uh-oh.
Having watched football for 25 years, I have no idea what the balls is XG expected goals. I honestly haven't got a clue. What is, I mean, I can guess that it's about goals we're expecting.
Yeah.
So
it's a good start.
For me, it's zero most weekends, right?
West Ham fan.
Exactly. But I mean, when do you come across the term XG in day-to-day life?
It's been a huge, huge thing developing in analytics over the last couple of years in football. and it was actually being used in Match of the Day this season. So for the first time ever, last Saturday, one of the stats they used alongside stuff like possession was actually the expected goals. And it's used to kind of analyse the chances that a team has in a game and total up how many goals they would be expected to score from those chances based on a range of factors, depending on where the shot's taking place, with what body part, the angle of the goal they've got, how many defenders are between them and the goal, where the goalkeeper is. And they got a database. I mean, the guys who work out the expected goals model have a database of loads and loads and loads of chances, meaning they can actually work out the chances of scoring. So say a ball comes into the box and Andy Carroll's got a header 6 yards out. That's going to have a very, very... It's going to have a very high expected goals likelihood of, you know, 0.7 chance of scoring, 0.6 chance of scoring, something like that. Whereas when Ross Barkley has a shot from 45 yards near the corner flag and it just goes over the bar and everyone goes, ooh, it's probably got like a 0.05% chance of actually going in. So those tallied together can actually work out the chance, how many goals the team are expected to score, whether or not they're overperforming or underperforming in what they've done. The benefit of that is you can look at a game and you can see that actually whether or not the scoreline reflects the likelihood of what's actually happened in that game. So, for example, if Liverpool, Watford, say Liverpool's expected goals had totaled up to 4.5 and Watford's is 1.5, then you'd know that Watford have been lucky to get the point. I'm not saying that is what happened because I haven't actually seen them. To go a bit further, you've also got expected assists. So that is the...
Right, is that XA?
That's XA.
That's
so
easy.
So that is the quality of chance that people are laying on. So again, someone like Payet, who you know well, the amount of chances he was creating last season before he left was basically the same as the chance he was creating the season before. But that doesn't actually look at the quality of the chance he's creating. Whereas actually...
They're all done with resentment. Does that come into the stats?
No, they can't measure it. I mean, they haven't got a database for that. But so if the quality of chances people are creating is actually worse and that chances created a metric is suddenly pretty pointless. If you're creating 10 chances in a game, but all of them a two-yard pass is left to Barkley to wallop it over the bar, then actually you're not doing really doing a great job. But if you're putting in amazing balls like Eriksen for Dele Alli to get on the end of from 6 yards out, then that's important. So it's an important metric to just understand how teams are performing. And over time, if you're constantly overperforming your XG, the chances are you're going to end up regressing over a period of time.
Overperforming your XG. Dave, this sounds like, to be honest, a load of bollocks to me. Surely it's not someone's job to be like, oh, that's a likely chance. Or less likely. But surely if it's a goal, it's a goal, right? So expected goals must, if you're counting all these things, someone like Leicester,
yeah,
like a couple of seasons ago, they basically won the league by having four chances a game. And
how was the quality of those chances, though?
I don't know.
Yeah, but exactly.
Don't put me on the spot. You're the experts here.
I think the big thing that you look at expected goals is it does, you know, in simplistic terms, it quantifies, you know, if you have a shot in the penalty area 100 times and your expected goals on that would be, let's say, 0.6, 60 out of the 100 shots would go in based on the historic data. And I think that's the big thing that is and isn't taken into consideration in the analytic community. Yes, you use big data, but unfortunately the Premier League is 38 games long, which actually is quite a small sample size. So to apply a metric that's based on millions and millions of data points in shots to a Premier League season, it's quite difficult. You know, you'd probably want to go down the line of using Bayesian theory to actually properly build an expected goals model.
Bayesian theory?
Bayesian theory is like basing it's building a model that you can predict the future
in a way. A stat.
Based on having like a mean or a variance of a certain nature. This is probably far too complicated. So it's basically you're predicting the future by an average of one of the players, let's say. So a player's goal scoring is going to score 10 goals in a season on average. You're basing that to apply to that, and then obviously you're predicting the future. The expected goals thing, I think it's an excellent model. I think it's good to quantify teams that overperform. For example, Nice under Lucien Favre. Lucien Favre, for his entire career, be it at Borussia, Mönchengladbach or Nice, has always outperformed his expected goals. But if you watch Lucien Favre, you know that his teams are excellent on the ball. They're really good footballing sides. So expected goals is just another metric, another one that will give you something and tell you something about it. But for me, there's things before, you know, you could say this expected goals model is perfect. There's things that aren't being quantified. For example, that seasonal nature of football. I think the other things you're not getting where, you know, where your opponent is, whether there's a block in front of you, whether there's a block in goal. That doesn't matter too much in terms of the grand over scale, but to quantify that shot better, to actually know that's got an XG of 0.7, you need to know what's around you. You need to know what sight of goal the player has. You know, I think
some models do take that in.
Some models do take that into consideration.
And that's the big issue, is that models, you know, lots of people have XG models and they vary, which isn't ideal, obviously, because some people will say that there's, you know, 1.5 for a team in a game and others will say 1.7, which isn't ideal.
Is it still fun watching football when you take
it
XG?
Enhances it.
How?
Because you understand.
It's actually a surprise, isn't it?
Because you understand a team's performance. And then another thing
it's like a spoiler alert.
To look at is it shows it's used massively in recruitment. And you can see when teams don't really know what they're doing when they go and buy some bloke who's just blown hot for 10 games, scored 9 goals, and his XG's actually been about 2.5, because the chances are he's not going to keep doing it.
But that's what purple patches are. I feel like it's taken the fun out of goal scoring.
No, goals are still there. I think the big thing is expected goals are a metric. And yeah, goals are a
tangible
in a way.
Thing.
Yeah, goals win games.
You don't
classic.
Win, you don't win points for XG, but it's good to have a high one.
you just win kudos.
Yeah, kudos from the community.
I sort of know what XG is. It's what it says it is, but it's ludicrously complicated to get there. XA is even worse.
It's something I think you'll find it more and more useful as it comes more into kind of general coverage, I think.
As it comes into the mainstream,
but
am I going to find it useful in my day-to-day
way,
life?
Way, way more enlightening as to what's happening in the game than shots taken or possession.
But then again, if you quantify where that shot's been taken, you can see, you can have a good. For example, if Rob's watching the game and his team, West Ham, have taken five shots from outside the penalty area, your XG is going to be low, right?
Yeah, of course.
If they have that's first half, let's say, in the second half, if they have five shots within the area, the XG is going to be high. So that's to look at it in simplistic terms. It's just, you know, the quality of a shot in a penalty area, you're more likely to score. Outside the penalty area, less likely to score. And that's what XG is as a metric. It just tells you where your shots are, how likely are, based on history, how many times did the ball go into the back of the net from that position?
Dave, you've used an example that requires West Ham to have five shots. As far as I'm you're talking nonsense. You're talking nonsense. So that's a term that I don't know. Now I'm going to get you both to tell me about a player I don't know. Could there even be such a thing?
Who's this fella?
How many times a day do you think you ask yourself that? How many times a day do you think you just like walk down the road and you're like, who's this fella?
Who's that?
Yeah, like pretty much generally in day-to-day life.
I don't know if I actually ask myself that question. I think I just think to myself, I don't know who he is.
Do you think in sentences, or do you think you thinking is just kind of done? You just come to the conclusion.
Your thinking
before.
Is just done.
Thinking is.
Mine's just numbers.
Do you think your thinking is done? What is just don't think anymore?
No, but like, do you think you just come up with your conclusion? This is for the defending the defending philosophy podcast.
I think this is next week. I'm embarrassed to ask. Just, I'm embarrassed to ask. Is your thinking done?
Is what? Rob Armstrong, is my thinking done? You can see it in A-level textbooks for years. So who is this fella, right? Is Jean-Michel Serres thinking just done?
Jean.
Billy Jean.
Jean.
All right, John. John Michael Serres plays for Nice, apparently.
Mm.
This is the guy that Liverpool are looking at because Naby Keita won't come, right? Or Keita.
Yeah.
What's his deal? Is his thinking just done?
Decent. Nah, he's done. He's done on the ball. He knows what he's doing on the ball for sure. He's completed more passes than any Nice player last season in Ligue 1. He's really important to Lucien Favre's style of football. Favre likes to play short passing out of the back, and he's a guy that's sort of running it in midfield. He's technically very gifted. Seems to be able to, you know, spot an opportunity and go and take that. He's one of the central midfielders that would be comfortable playing left wing, right wing, attacking midfield, but also central midfield. It gets such quality and defensive midfield. I think he's similarly to Naby Keita, how he's quite an all-round midfielder. He can do it all. Why Liverpool want him so much is because he can attack, he can defend, he can do pretty much everything on a football pitch. Sarri's quite similar to that in a way, where he's an all-round complete midfielder. And I think that's why the likes of Barcelona, that's why the likes of Liverpool are looking at him, because he's just so hot at every part of his game. And we're sort of seeing that the evolution of football in a way is to become a player that can play anywhere, anytime. You know, think about the sort of Dutch team from 74 in the World Cup, where it was
James
all fluid.
James Collins as well
would be perfect in terms of a centre-half that come out into defensive midfield and boss the show with the ball at his feet. But I think it's one of these things where football is evolving for players that are so dynamic and so good at everything that they could play in multiple positions and then switch positions. I think that's potentially where it could go. You know, imagine a fullback switching with a defensive midfielder. That's where I kind of see it.
I can't imagine
that's what's going to happen next.
This just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, unlike Keita, the reason I think Keita was such an exciting prospect for Liverpool fans was just his transition from defence into attack. He could get the ball and basically just drive from deep. And Serri's much more of a kind of a passer, I'd say.
Loser.
More of a creative player. And you wonder if, you know, he wouldn't necessarily add that extra dimension to Liverpool that Keita would have done. He'd definitely be, you know, an upgrade on what they've already got. You know, 7 goals last season in league, 9 assists, 73 chances created. That just shows that he's a bloke who, on the ball, when his foot's on it, he can do stuff with it. My one other concern is that he's basically so far, you know, he's in his mid-20s, he's had one decent season under Lucien Favre when he came into Nice, and you've got to wonder whether or not he is a player who's got a system set up to suit him at the moment. He's got a manager who's getting the best out of him, and whether or not he would, once moving on, if he'd regain that form, if he'd go back to the player he was before. But having said that, he does look like one of the kind of available, if he is available, one of the most available best options that clubs have got in centre midfield. He is versatile, as Dave said, so it makes sense. And he looks class.
You're saying about fullback and midfield, and then you're expressing concerns. He sounds like an exotic James Milner to me. In fact, he's even got like a bit of a boring name if you take away the Serri bit. Like in France, is his name just John Michael? John Michael Serri.
Jean Michel.
It could be
French James Milner. Is that what he is? Is he James Milner with a big price tag and in his mid-20s?
No, I think he's better on the ball than James Milner. James Milner's a decent player, but if Liverpool were to acquire the Ivorian international, they'd be getting a great player. And that's why Barca are sniffing around as well, because he has that
talent.
He's
Ivorian, not French. How embarrassing.
But I think, yeah, it's one of these things where Liverpool have got to look at their midfield, what we spoke about earlier on. It's very similar. Can is the same player to Wijnaldum, who's the same player to Jordan Henderson. They get that mix in there. They've got a playmaker in there that can actually control the tempo of a game, and that's what they've been lacking. So it makes massive sense, and at €40 million, which is his release clause, would be good business. But the problem is, Liverpool are going to be losing Coutinho to Barcelona and could be losing out with the Sarri transfer to, again, Barcelona, who are in massive transition at the moment.
The Barcelona need. They've got Paulinho, you know. So
we've got the Paulinho one's an interesting one. I've seen him. He's been absolutely slammed. Paulinho's been awesome over the last calendar year. Been really good. like playing at a really good level. Yeah, Tottenham, he wasn't great at all. But
playing
then
at really, wait, playing at a really good level. He's playing in China, isn't he?
But also,
it's a NAF level.
If you think about the Brazilian national team scoring hat tricks from central midfield,
yeah, that's like scoring a free pointer for the Harlem Globetrotters, isn't it?
It could be. I just don't think you can overlook good form in the Chinese Super League and good form for a national team. To £40 million in this market, €40 million in this market isn't much. So to get someone like Sarri's quality, it's good. But to get Paulinho as well, it's not a bad deal.
It's also amusing to see the British public thinking that they can judge Paulinho signing based on two seasons at Spurs better than the Real Madrid, better than the Barcelona recruitment team.
Yeah, interesting.
Because I think that they probably have a fair idea of what they're getting themselves in for.
But that being said, Neymar to Paulinho and
Neymar to Coutinho. You know.
Yeah, like Coutinho, what is he going? Is he going to end up going for like 100 million quid, 110 million quid?
Mm,
he's like not it, even yeah. Liverpool's best player. Like, he's not as good as Sané, is he? Sané? Mané?
Mané. I think he is, yeah. I think Mane's a better goal scorer. But I think in terms of a player who'd suit Barcelona more, in terms of potential to and their kind of their ceiling, I'd say Coutinho's basically got it all.
Although Mané would be a perfect replacement to Neymar. Likes to play wide on the left, that's can right. dribble, can take people on.
I think he'd be too direct, wouldn't he? I don't think he'd be...
New Barcelona under Valdeverde, it's a new life, new pressing football, new aggressive. Lionel Messi potentially is a number 10. They could do with a left winger. Maybe they just get Coutinho and Mane, €200 million.
The John Michael, Paul, Eno.
Yeah.
And I can't think of how to do Coutinho.
Phil.
Is that, yeah.
Big
exactly.
Phil.
John Michael, Phil and Paul.
Yeah.
Is that the future of the Barcelona midfield? It's hardly Xavi, Iniesta and Busquets.
I don't think Busquets is going to get moved out there. I think Rakitic, I don't think he's fallen out of favour a little bit. His performance levels haven't been as high as they were when Barcelona went to go and lift the treble a few seasons ago. And in terms of Andres Iniesta, he's still one of the best central midfielders in world football in terms of controlling games. He's just a little bit crocked at the moment. His knees are starting to wear out, which is a problem for a central midfielder when you want your playmaker to play every single game. And I think that's why Barca are looking at the likes of Eriksen, looking at Coutinho as guys that could come in and replace the great Andres Iniesta.
So you're giving me a lot of opinions, guys, but we're not here for opinion. I don't want to see you get along in amiable conversation. I want to see you get to the facts, the objective numbers. It's time for a stats showdown.
Defending in numbers.
Picture the scene. It's like the end of Good, the Bad and the Ugly. Eli Wallach, Lee Van Cleef and Clint Eastwood are stood eyeing each other up in a graveyard.
You think you're lucky, punk?
Ennio Morricone, or maybe Morricone, or however it's pronounced, is playing in the background. I'm Eli Wallach. I'm having nothing to do with this, basically. I'm just going to run away with whoever the winner is. You two are Lee Van Cleef and Clint Eastwood. One of you is good, one of you is bad. And we're going to use stats and vague analogies to try and decide who the king of stats is, I guess. Who's taking home the unnamed grave? If you haven't seen Good, the Bad and the Ugly, I strongly suggest it. Otherwise, you're never going to understand football, are you?
Or expected you.
Right, who's going to go first this week? I'm going to take a look into your eyes and see who's the most honest. George, you're far more honest. George, you're going with the opening stat this week. Round one of the stats showdown.
Yeah, so my stats have all come from the opening weekend of the Premier League. Topical. Obviously. First one, Southampton had 29 shots against Swansea, but couldn't find the back of the net. Leicester, Huddersfield and Watford combined had 25 shots, so four less, and scored 9 goals.
Blown away.
And just 11% of Saints' 29 shots were on target, which is also poor.
Holy
just a,
shit.
That's just a sub-stat for you.
Is this I've one stat or two stats?
Sub-stat.
I'm ignoring that sub-stat. It's against the rules. You can't bring three guns. To a gunfight. Dave, come back. You've got to blow me away.
So, Romelu Lukaku has scored more goals in the Premier League. Cristiano Ronaldo, Fernando Torres, Luis Suarez and the great Eric Cantona.
I was waiting for a combine there just to make it a good stat, but it didn't come. So.
Some Manchester United legends in there. Romelu Lukaku, only 24. I'd say, Dave, you've surprised me more. You got 1-0 up. Now you have the opportunity to clinch it in the second round. It's your go. Blow me away with a stat.
Finish him. Nemanja Matic.
Don't do that.
Oh, no. I think it's going to be Matic versus Matic.
It's going to be a Matic off. So Nemanja Matic, this weekend, of course, played partner to Paul Pogba, unleashing the Pog. But Matic was actually controlling the tempo, had more touches than any other player, completed more passes, but more importantly, covered the most distance. For something for Manchester United, a team that covered the fewest kilometres per game in the Premier League last season, that is a massive signing.
I reckon he played a lot of Pogs when he was young.
Yes.
Remember Tazos?
Yeah, they were decent.
Yeah. Was that like the English Pogs? Because I've heard of Pogs, but I don't think I ever actually saw one. Anyway, George.
So my Matic stat. So a lot of talk about the liberated Man U last year. They looked very constrained last season. This time they were playing with a flourish. And Nemanja Matic, against West Ham, completed 7 out of 7 completed take-ons compared to last season in the duration where he only completed 31. So he's nearly a quarter of the way there after one game.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you've both gone for stats against West Ham. So if I was Eli Wallach, no. Dave?
No.
I'm not impressed.
Okay.
I am impressed by the 7 take-ons. Yeah. So he's only got, what, 4 more games until he tops last season.
Yeah, if he carries on like that, yeah.
Fair play, Matic. Round 2. Electrifying. So now we have the showdown, the final shot. This is the duel at dawn, which doesn't happen in the good, the bad and the ugly.
So obviously the one game I'm going to go to for my big final stat was the West Brom-Bournemouth game, the one that everyone was looking forward to.
Yeah, that was the highlight fixture.
Andrew Sermon with 90 and Harry Arter with 92 completed passes in that game, totalling combined the two centre midfielders 182, 30 more than the whole West Brom team put together with 152, and they still lost 1-0.
My God, possession, does it mean nothing anymore?
What was the XG though, anyone? Rob?
The XG? Meaningless. Bunch of lunatics sat in a room probably. Dave? Stat me.
I know that I've already lost just because this is another stat against the mighty Irons.
Thanks.
Anthony Martial has scored or assisted a goal every 6.5 minutes in the Premier League this season, the best record. If he continues this rate, he'll be directly involved in over 500 Premier League goals.
Christ. But Dave, what you're telling me there really is that he came on as a sub and scored.
And assisted.
And assisted.
Yeah.
In 12 minutes.
In 12 minutes. 13 minutes.
Yeah, but didn't Morata do, like, he did that in 20 minutes or something?
Yeah, but it wasn't...
And got a disallowed goal as well.
Yeah, and that was against the mighty Burnley. Martial did it against West Ham.
9 men.
Yeah, goals only count half against West Ham. Okay. Hang your head in shame. You've just been shot by Lee Van Cleef. The good lost.
Get in.
George, you've won that stat showdown.
Cheers, mate.
And with that stat showdown, and George walking around the very small room victorious... Stripping off like Cristiano Ronaldo. While he's doing that, Dave, I'm going to ask you, where can people find you if they want to talk to you?
On the internet.
And listen to you.
On YouTube, on Twitter. Just search Stat Man Dave. Simple.
He's a man who does stats and his name is Dave.
Yeah.
And George, now you've got your top back on. Where can people find you?
Yeah, just on Twitter, at George Ellick. If you want to tell me I'm wrong about anything.
Spell it.
George Ellek.
It's exactly how you think. The best thing is, it's exactly how you think it's going to be spelled.
Well, you say that.
And then you pronounce it, and it's exactly how you think you're going to say it.
The amount of people get it wrong, you wouldn't believe.
Mm. XE. Expected errors of George's name. equally irrelevant. And you can follow me at @RobArmstrong_WH. Or go to the Football Republic on YouTube. And every now and again, I talk on there as well. But that's all for Defending in Numbers this week. But there's always a next week, Dave. Even for West Ham, there is always a next week. And we'll see you then.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.
Deezer Originals.
That was Defending in Numbers, a brand new Deezer Originals podcast brought to you by Squawker. We'll be back with a new episode of the Squawker Talker next week. See you then.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.